previously.
I had a couple really want to push. He really likes the hot tub. To say, well, you know, his sperm count's really low, so if he can leave the testicles outside the hot tub and get in the hot tub, then it's okay.
You know, I really don't even want to think about that.
Don't try that one at home.
Right, right, right.
This is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Lisa Hansard with Dr. Thomas Vaughn from the Texas Fertility Center. Welcome to this week's edition of Beyond the Birds and the Bees. Today's topic is going to be what you can do to improve your fertility. Thomas, hi.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm just fine.
Glad to hear that. Can you tell our audience, if they're brand spanking new to this program, a little bit about what we do?
Yes, there's four of us, soon to be five physicians that are formally trained in reproductive endocrinology and infertility that practice together at the Texas Fertility Center. And what we do is we really just focus all our attention on helping couples conceive that have had trouble becoming pregnant. We are actually, our basic training is in obstetrics and gynecology, and even though we're board certified and we've delivered lots of babies, we don't do that anymore. We don't even do pap smears. We do not do anything but help couples become pregnant. Our main office is on Mopac at 6500 North Mopac, and we have a website that's just been spectacular, txfertility.com. Most websites will have maybe 30 or 40 pages to it. This one has over 150. We developed it to make it a resource for individuals that are looking for answers in this difficult struggle.
Great. Well, moving into today's topic, we are looking at lifestyle choices that can significantly impact a couple's chances of conceiving. And we practice what we call evidence-based medicine, meaning that we want to see that there's conclusive data that supports a recommendation about a treatment, about lifestyle, etc. And a lot of couples are lost in this process and wondering if there's anything that they're doing wrong, what are they doing right? What can help them get pregnant? And so we want to focus a little bit on social behaviors in terms of sexual practices, smoking, caffeine, alcohol intake. And then we'll go to some more physical choices or physical issues like weight, exercise, physical stress, environmental chemicals that can affect fertility as well.
I would like to remind everyone, too, about age. And this is the age of the egg, so to speak, or the age of the woman trying to conceive. This is really important that if a couple has been together for a while, and as a woman gets into her mid to late 30s, she needs to be thinking about trying to get pregnant if she wants to have a baby rather than putting it off. It kind of reminds you that most couples are kind of like, I need to get everything set. I need to get the car paid for, get the house, get everything, get my career set. But the problem is that we can't change the age of the egg, so to speak. And fertility starts declining actually in the early 20s, but the significant decline is really in the early 30s. So that's real important. On the other hand, we're not telling women just to have a baby because they're getting older if their relationship's not in the proper place. But it is something that when everything is where it should be, that couples should go ahead and have babies early in their marriage. Don't you agree?
I absolutely do. I want to remind our listening audience that we are live and we are taking callers. The number is 390-1370 and it is 1210. So we are live on Saturday, June 12th at the talk radio station off of 360 in West Bank Drive. Getting back to the topic of age, I had an interesting conversation with one of the gynecologists here in town, Dr. Karen Swenson, a couple of weeks ago. And she was telling me about a woman that she's seen for multiple years who comes in for her annual exam and her pap smear and so on. And every time she comes in, Karen says, what are you doing about your fertility? And the woman, I think, now is 40 or 41, and they've been having this conversation for the last 3 or 4 years. And the woman is married and not using birth control. And Dr. Swenson said, are you going to go see the fertility specialist at Texas Fertility Center? And the woman said to her, "We're just not ready to make that decision yet to go see them and pursue treatment." And Karen told me something really, really interesting, and I've thought about this a lot lately. She told this this patient of hers that by not making a decision, she really is making a decision. The decision she's making is to not become pregnant and to decrease her chances of achieving a pregnancy the longer she goes. Because we all know that if you haven't gotten pregnant after 12 to 24 months of unprotected intercourse, the odds of that happening without assistance is extremely low. So not pursuing treatment is making a decision.
I think that's a real important issue to talk about, too. And that is, you talked about the definition of fertility, but how many times have we seen patients who say, "Well, we haven't used contraception for 3 or 4 years, but we've only been trying for 6 months.
We've only really been trying."
Right. And what does that mean? I'm not sure. We won't talk about what that means. But anyway, what does that really mean? I'm sure they're thinking about trying to time intercourse around ovulation. But, you know, we would never have gotten out of the caves if we had to think about this before. So just being sexually active once or twice a week, conception should occur within 6 to 12 months.
Absolutely. Right. The Cave people didn't have ovulation predictor.
No, they
kits.
Didn't. They didn't have physicians to help them, and they still made it.
Yep.
But, you know, the difference with them is that they were probably much younger
when they started.
Just,
that's exactly
yes, that's right. Okay, puberty is time to have a baby.
That's exactly right.
But so what we're saying about that is we're not trying to get women to get pregnant so early in life that is inappropriate for them. What we're saying is that as they delay getting pregnant for good reasons, like they want to finish their education, they want to find the right guy, maybe they want to get their career established, to once they get to a point, go ahead and think about this if it's important. The patient of Dr. Swenson's, probably she's telling us that it's really not that important
right.
to her, because we all know Karen, and Karen will tell it like it is, and she'll really be straight with them and be very honest. And I think that patient probably is just not sure she wants to be pregnant.
Well, I'm going to tell you a personal story. I think you may have heard this before, but I was that person, and I was married at 23 and on my career path, went to medical school, started my residency, and I had this same thought that somewhere down the road, there's going to be this perfect time to start a family. And when I was a second-year resident doing my infertility rotation in San Antonio, I spent a week in the office with those reproductive endocrinologists. I came home on that Friday, and I told my husband, "We have to get pregnant right now." And he said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Right now, like right now." And he was obviously taken aback, and I mean, he was more than happy to practice, but yeah, let's start practicing. But I said, I just spent a week with women just like me. And so even being in this field, I had this perception of, well, it's not going to be a problem. When I decide I want to be pregnant, it'll just happen. Now, the flip side of that, being overly anxious about it, I have an 18-year-old daughter from, well, probably not that night. Maybe. Yeah, I digress.
We don't want to know what night.
Too much information. We practiced a lot. So anyway, my 18-year-old daughter, when people talk to her about what I do and about planning family and so on, she said, "Well, my mother says that I have to have my first baby by 25. And that if I have a husband, that would be, that would be an added benefit, but not necessarily mandatory." And I don't think that I've really gone to that extreme. Well, maybe I have, but because I'm kind of ready to be a grandma. Not really, Madison, cover your ears, or Mallory, or Lord Jaden. Yeah, let's not go there. But there is, it's like you said, you want your life to be settled and you want to be ready, but you have to think about, are you ever really, really, really going to be ready?
There's never a perfect time.
There is not a perfect time. I'm a living testimonial poster child for not a perfect time.
And just think, Lisa, as you obviously with this education, the majority of us that go through medical school, residency, and then fellowship, We're 34 years old when we finish training. If you'd put having babies off that long, you may have had problems.
That's exactly
right. I mean, so it is good to move along. And do you think it really interfered with your career?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But at the time, I thought this is going to be devastating and I have to make a choice and I can't do both things. And of course, it wasn't that way. And in retrospect, it would have been far worse to get through that experience and then have had trouble conceiving.
And don't you think that there's a little component of this that women are working or a little bit intimidated to become pregnant and start a family for fear that they'll be looked upon as if they're not as productive in their career? And I have a daughter, as you know, and she's pregnant, and she's an anesthesiologist. And I'm sure that crossed her mind, too, about is it going to put a bigger burden on her partners to be out for pregnancy?
We hear it every single day in the office with, oh, my gosh, with our patients who come in and they're really, really on a career path and they're traveling and they're trying to plan their treatment cycle around when they have to travel for work. And I don't want to tell my boss that I'm going through this because it's going to change their perception, when really having children and building a family is the most natural thing in the world.
It's probably the most important thing.
It absolutely is.
It really is. There's nothing more important than family. So I think that what we need to do is be sure everyone understands that a delay or an indecision really is a decision, and age is one of the hardest things for us to overcome.
And that's the majority of our patients, I would say, that are in our office as new patients are in their mid to late 30s and beyond. And sometimes it's not a first pregnancy that they're trying to achieve. But as we get older, even if we've had successes as younger women, as we get older, it's going to be harder and harder to become pregnant. And it's going to be a lot riskier miscarriage-wise.
For sure. As we know, as the egg ages, so to speak, that the chance of conceiving goes down and the chance of losing the pregnancy goes up. So you get a compounding negative effect there. It's almost like it accelerates.
That's exactly right.
So the baby rate then is therefore less.
Right. And I was looking at some interesting statistics. We were talking about women who had recurrent miscarriages. And, you know, we tell people that maybe 25 to 35% of all pregnancies end in miscarriage. And that's just because we're very, very complex individuals. And, you know, everything has to be perfect to make a human being. But if you look at the spread, you'll see that if you're 20 years old, the risk of a miscarriage may be 15%. By the time you're 45, it's 70 to 80%.
It's unbelievable.
So it's not just getting pregnant. Then the challenge, particularly as you get older, is staying pregnant.
You know, it's interesting because I think a lot of couples and women specifically think about the increasing risk of Down syndrome as they get older.
Right.
But they don't think about these other two issues. But let's say if this 45-year-old woman beat all the odds, chance of getting pregnant less than 5%, gets pregnant, chance of miscarriage 70%. Makes it through that, the chance of Downs is probably 2 to 3%.
That's exactly right.
It's so much less, but that's what we're all afraid of, and it's an appropriate thing to be concerned about. But really, the focus is getting a pregnancy that doesn't miscarry.
Right, and I tell these women who come in, you know, with that concern, we got to get there first. We've got to get to that 12 or 13-week mark before we talk about those kinds of testing.
Very, very important. And I, as we kind of move into these other aspects of social behavior besides delay in childbearing, smoking itself is one of those things that can make the ovary age faster.
That's exactly right.
And it actually is such a direct impact on the egg and the quality of the egg that it actually can destroy eggs. And women may go through menopause at an earlier age. And someone who smokes one or two packs a day may not have menopause at the age of 50, but maybe at the age of 47 or 48 or even earlier, well, her chance of conceiving goes away at an earlier age also.
Well, I think public awareness has been fabulous about smoking and its effect on health, lung cancer, respiratory disease, heart disease. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the effect of smoking on fertility and just what the public awareness is, or really lack of awareness is, when it comes to trying to achieve a a pregnancy. Again, our call-in number is 390-1370. It's 1221 on Saturday.
And we'll see you in a minute.
Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
If you're just now joining us, this is Dr. Lisa Hanser, joined by Dr. Thomas Vaughn from the Texas Fertility Center. And our topic today is what you can do to improve your fertility. And we went to break, we were starting to talk a little bit about the effects of smoking on reproduction. And, you know, there was a poll that was done to look at public awareness of the effects of smoking. And 99% of the folks that were polled knew that lung cancer and respiratory disease and heart disease were all directly related to smoking. But when you look at factors like infertility, early menopause, less than 25% of the public was aware that smoking had any impact at all on these fertility-related issues, as well as miscarriage, osteoporosis, and ectopic pregnancies. So let's discuss a little bit about how smoking does impact fertility.
Yeah, smoking is one of the most significant adverse effects that a woman can have on her fertility. And it, of course, it's one of those things where she can stop smoking and significantly improve her chances of conceiving. And remember, smoking also increases the risk of miscarriage. Once again, we get this compounding effect. We lower the chance of getting pregnant, then we increase and almost double the chance of miscarriage if a woman is smoking. And I think it's just one of those things that you can really do something to affect your fertility significantly.
You know, women who come to our office, and they're never very happy to tell us that they smoke, because I don't think that's something that most people are very proud of, but they always say, I'm going to stop smoking when I get pregnant. And there's this whole educational process of having to explain to them the impact it has on the becoming pregnant part. One of the ways that that I approach this, because I've never been a smoker, so I cannot pretend to know how difficult it is to stop. But one of the approaches I say is, listen, we're going to take a team approach. And on my end, I'm going to do everything I possibly can to try to make whatever treatment we do work for you. On your end, you've got to look at your lifestyle choices and do everything you can. And a lot of times when they look at it that way, they'll say, okay, it's worth it. I understand that it's not just one thing. It's a combination of things. And this is something that I have control over.
I agree. Very important. It is important to say, or to make patients realize that we'll work on this as a team effort, not go home, quit smoking, and then come back when you've quit. But we need to work on this together. And you know, some of the coronary artery disease that's been looked at in individuals who smoke, when guys or women have catheterizations, mm-hmm. and then they get their real wake-up call, like, oh, I almost died, and they recath them, it's several months before it appears that the artery is going through a healing process. And we can't prove this because I guess you don't catheterize a uterine artery very much to look for this, but it makes sense that it would follow for this to be the same for the vascular supply to the uterus and the ovaries. So there's a vascular phenomenon in addition to the direct toxic effect that smoking has on eggs.
That's right. There's actually been some research that's looked at this and shown that the vascularization to the uterine cavity during the menstrual cycle, and therefore the receptiveness of the uterus to implantation, is significantly reduced in smokers, and that is also completely reversible. Now, in terms of the eggs that may have been damaged or may have been lost, that's not going to be reversible, but if you stop now, we see a marked improvement fairly rapidly.
Yeah, and you know, this is exactly why you don't want a patient to wait until she becomes pregnant to quit smoking. What they're saying is it's so hard to quit that we don't quite have the motivation to quit smoking, particularly if we're not educated about the ill effect it has on fertility. You know, I think women, though, we're more likely to get them to quit than the men to quit, because the women also realize that smoking can hurt their baby and significantly hurt their baby. I actually had a patient when I was delivering babies in the early 80s that smoked, she said, 7 packs a day.
Wow, holy cow. I cannot believe it.
7 packs a day. She never let one go out. And so
she would be so rich if she didn't smoke.
Certainly today. And she could only cut down to 2 packs a day during her pregnancy. And her baby barely weighed 4 pounds.
Holy cow.
What a, you know, that's almost, as you get into this stuff about child abuse is pretty harsh. Mm-hmm. But that really is really a big issue. And I never could get her to quit. And she actually changed physicians because we wouldn't let her smoke in our waiting room.
Oh, my goodness.
Back when you could smoke in the waiting rooms. Yeah, so it's pretty impressive. So just think what happened to this baby. And so we can help the babies also. So it just continues to translate into good reasons to quit smoking if you can.
Yeah, there's been a high association with serious infant health problems in smokers, with cerebral palsy, stillbirth, and even mental retardation being associated. But that's the female end. So, you know, most of the time we can convince women that this impacts their egg quality. It's certainly going to impact their pregnancy and increase risks of abnormalities to their kiddos. What about the guys?
There's actually a significant effect on the guys, sperm production and sperm function. And for many years, it was felt maybe it was only in sperm function, but there actually was one study that looked at in vitro fertilization, the chance of conceiving in smokers versus non-smokers, and that's the men. And this study involved women who did not breathe secondhand smoke. We'll get to secondhand smoke in a minute. So this is important because that meant that this was isolated, the effect of smoking on the men, where the women didn't breathe their smoke. And the pregnancy rate for IVF for non-smokers in that group was 32%, and in smokers was 18%.
Yikes.
And, you know, that's pretty significant. And also, when they underwent ICSI, now that's where you inject the sperm directly into the egg, the pregnancy rate was much higher in non-smokers compared to smokers. So that kind of took away the issue of maybe it just interferes with sperm penetration, because in this procedure, you're overcoming the need for the sperm to penetrate an egg, and yet the pregnancy rates were still quite low in the couples where the guy smoked, even if the woman wasn't exposed to smoke. Pretty impressive. And so, of course, that brings up secondhand smoke. Do you know what third-hand smoke is? Have you heard of third-hand smoke? Third-hand smoke is kind of interesting. Everybody knows what secondhand smoke is. Third-hand smoke is where maybe someone smokes in their house, and you go into their house, they're not there, so you're not breathing their smoke. You don't smoke, but you're breathing it from the carpets and and the furniture and everything else. Somebody, I'm sure, will look and see if that's detrimental. But back to secondhand smoke, clearly detrimental. What we have strongly encouraged our couples to do is for the one, if they both smoke, for them both to quit. The second best thing is that the woman quits and at least does not breathe husband smoke. And I've even told them that if parents smoke, they can't go visit their parents. They have to come to neutral territory, so they're not breathing the cigarette smoke.
And pretty much anywhere you go in Austin's going to be neutral territory.
True.
Being smoke-free.
But you know, I have to, Lisa and I both trained at Duke University, which was built on
tobacco money.
Tobacco money.
Thanks, y'all.
So, yeah, I know.
Thanks for smoking to help me and Thomas.
That's right.
But don't do it anymore.
Yes. Yes. So smoking, I'm sure everybody got the message, it's not a good thing, right?
Smoking's bad.
Yep. And just think how much money you can save now. It's so expensive.
Very, very true.
Well, let's talk a minute about something positive in social behavior, folic acid. Now, folic acid is not an issue. It's not something that you take to improve your fertility, but it significantly decreases the chance of problems with the baby if the woman's on folic acid when she conceives.
That's right. And so when we, it's one of the first things we ask women when we see them in the office is, are you taking a prenatal vitamin? And if you are, does it have at least 800 micrograms of folic acid? And we've seen a marked decrease in a particular kind of abnormality in babies called neural tube defects, which are things like spina bifida. And we think now that folic acid may be protective for some other conditions like cerebral palsy and other neurological problems down the road. So that's something that you can do that's cheap and easy and very proactive in getting as healthy as possible prior to achieving a pregnancy.
In case someone's out there that doesn't know what spina bifida is, what is spina bifida?
Spina bifida is where there is an abnormality in the typically in the base of the spinal column, where the core doesn't have the vertebra covering all the way down, and it causes significant neural damage and typically paralysis.
And the babies can't control bladder function and bowel function forever. So this is something really simple, and I tell my patients, you know, take your 800 micrograms of folic acid, or you can eat Brussels sprouts three times a day. And
yeah,
even if you like Brussels sprouts three times a day, it's a bit
not
much.
Not going to happen.
One other thing that's kind of interesting about folic acid, there's one study recently that said if women have been on folic acid for a year prior to conception, they may have a little lower risk of premature labor. So it seems to be something that's really worthwhile. That's a positive thing.
Okay, let's move on to that triple espresso on the way to work every morning.
Yeah, how about caffeine?
How about caffeine?
You know, and the data on caffeine does show that there's a decreased chance in conceiving, increased chance of miscarry in women who ingest an excessive amount of caffeine.
What is excessive amount?
Well, there's studies that look at different levels, and basically the best one I found says that if you exceed 100 milligrams of caffeine a day, and that would be the equivalent of a coffee cup, one of those kind of English-looking things with the real skinny little handles on it,
mm-hmm,
not one of the really powerful double-caffeinated drinks, but that's 100 milligrams. So for the patients that really like coffee, I've asked them to mix some decaf with their caffeinated coffee, particularly if they make it at home and they put like four scoops in their coffee maker, maybe eventually get down to one scoop of caffeinated and three scoops of decaffeinated. And the one other thing I wanted to throw in, it's important to know that decaffeinated coffee does have some caffeine, but it's pretty minimal. It's like 2 to 3 milligrams. That's a very small amount.
That's right. And, you know, it's also important to be aware that it's not just coffee. Sodas, iced tea, all these things contain caffeine. And there was one study that looked at a dosage as low as 50 milligrams a day being associated with premature birth of 3 to 4 weeks early in women who smoked during their pregnancy. So
smoked or caffeine? Or
I'm sorry.
Ingested caffeine.
Have you been smoking?
No, I'm just kidding.
Well, not cigarettes. Wait, no, what? No,
not
wait.
On the set.
Well, you know, the rot rally's going on and all.
Get in the mood, right?
Oh, goodness gracious.
Well, you know, the other thing is that caffeine is not only in coffee, tea, and colas, but chocolate.
Do not take away chocolate.
Midol and Excedrin.
Which, that's true.
Now, here's the deal, okay? There's not any caffeine in white chocolate or in carob. Now, don't tell anybody that white chocolate's really not chocolate. It's just cocoa butter or something like that.
You just did.
Shh, don't say that. But anyway, white chocolate tastes pretty good.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I think you can have like a little Hershey's Kiss every once in a while.
I would think so. I would certainly think so. So keep that in mind. That's something else that couples, women can do to improve their chances of fertility. There's not any real data that I know of that shows detrimental effect on men. There's all sorts of studies that have shown increase in sperm movement when you put caffeine in a dish with sperm. I don't think that translates into what guys are doing with sexual activity. So it's all over the place. But what I tell my couples is, you have to suffer too. This is called marriage.
Oh, is that the part where you suffer or wait?
No, this is the first part where you suffer. And so what you have to do is you can't sit around with this huge pot of coffee while your wife watches you. And she can't drink any coffee. So you got to sneak it at
that's
work.
Because that's just wrong.
That is wrong. That's wrong. And you just can't eat all this chocolate at the show. And your wife is sitting there staring.
Well, and to kind of parlay into that, you also can't like knock back your six pack of beer on a Friday night and your wife's over there drinking soda.
Yeah.
Decaffeinated soda.
Right, right. And in fact, we'll talk about alcohol. How about that?
We can talk about alcohol.
All right. Well, let's do that, because there really is some data on alcohol and fertility, and particularly with in vitro fertilization. Now, some of the problems are trying to quantitate the alcohol and the kind of alcohol that you drink. There was one study in Europe which was really interesting, and actually it was just a questionnaire, it's retrospective, so it's not the pure scientific look at answering a question, but they contacted people who quit their fertility treatment and found couples that did conceive, and looked at the length of time between not using contraception and conceiving, and actually it was longer if the women ingested a significant amount of alcohol. Except in the group that just did a little bit of alcohol, and actually with red wine, it was a little bit shorter. That's kind of interesting. So I guess...
I like that.
Yeah, you can kind of draw a conclusion from that...
You can draw your own conclusions. I know what kind I'm drawing.
Okay. Well, that...
Do you have a corkscrew back there, Jessica, anywhere?
Typically we do.
So really, once a woman ovulates, she's pregnant, so she shouldn't drink.
Right.
I mean, it's supposed to be zero tolerance.
Right.
And leading up to that, it should be moderate, and maybe wine is better than margaritas and bourbon.
Sounds good. We're getting ready to go on break, but we have something fun. We have a giveaway. This is from myaustinperks.com. And I'd like to give a quick thanks to Capital City Comedy Club. They are giving away a $50 gift certificate to our 10th caller during this break. So give us a buzz at 390-1370, and we will be back with you after a few minutes.
Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Thanks for coming back with us. Over the break, we have a winner, Sean McCormick, who is the proud owner of a $50 gift certificate to Capital City Comedy Club. So thanks for listening.
Thanks, Sean. Appreciate it.
When we left, we were talking a little bit about alcohol, and all I really remember is that red wine is good.
Selective listening,
sorry,
huh?
Yeah, whatever. That's what my husband says.
Guys were supposed to do that.
Well, I use it to my advantage whenever possible. So he will definitely vouch for that. So we've talked about the effect that alcohol has on women and its success with fertility treatments. And as we all know, problems with pregnancy if you continue to drink. What about guys? Are they off the hook, or is there effect for them with alcohol consumption?
Well, you know what? There's two reasons they're not off the hook. Number one is they have to suffer in marriage.
You keep bringing that up.
Well, they just can't sit around and drink a lot of alcohol while their wife's going, I wish I could have a glass of wine. That's just not fair. But anyway, there was. I've only seen one study a couple years ago that actually looked at couples that were drinking as they were trying to conceive, and there was a small group where only the guys were drinking, and they said if they drank in excess but did not explain or define what excess was, that the pregnancy rates were lower for them as a couple. So there is some data there. It's a little bit harder to sort out alcohol data and a little bit with caffeine as well, because people don't really realize how much they drink. And
right.
Some people say, well, I just drink a little bit, just one glass of wine. Well, it's like 10 feet tall or something, you know?
one glass bottle,
right,
of wine.
And so that, I think that makes it really difficult, particularly when they do these questionnaires. But I think there's enough there to say, if we're going to drink, it should be in moderation.
Right.
And I think that's common sense, too.
I think so, too. So other things that we can do, let's talk a little bit about weight. So we know that being at actually either of the extremes of weight is a problem. And there was a study that was published by the CDC. It's really just a demographic study, but I found it pretty amazing. So when we talk about obesity, we're talking about the percentage of body fat compared to the lean body mass in an individual. And obesity is described as a body mass index of greater than 30. And looking back 20 years ago, in 1991, only 10 to 14% of Americans, and it varies by state, this is how the CDC breaks it down because they look at things epidemiologically, had a BMI greater than 30. By 1996, it was 19%. By 2001, depending on what state you lived in, it was up to 24%. And hovering around 29% in 2006. Two states, it's nice to not be like the worst, you know, because sometimes we're like Texas is the worst. But Mississippi and West Virginia have over 30% of their population in the obese range. So let's talk a little bit about what impact that has on fertility.
Yeah, but let's also realize Texas is, they may say the word, worst, but we're the best in everything else.
We sure are. Yeah, we rock.
We are Texas, and some people want to secede from the Union, even
that's
though
exactly that right.
We're so proud of being Texas. But anyway, clearly weight has an impact. And if you just consider women, there's sort of a window of an ideal weight in terms of ovulation and function in terms of ovarian function, and that is, as you mentioned earlier, Lisa, you can weigh too little and therefore not have enough body fat. And that could be women who with anorexia or women who exercise too much. We'll come to exercise in a minute. Are the women who have gained weight, maybe for whatever genetics or not exercising or poor eating habits and don't ovulate either. And they have different hormonal profiles, but the bottom line is that they're not ovulating regularly if they're too heavy or if they're too light. So it's important to try to work on staying within a range that is normal. And there is even data that you were talking about, too, where women may have a high BMI, yet they're still ovulating, but their chance of conceiving is still lower.
That's right.
And even when we do in vitro fertilization, so maybe they're not ovulating, we can correct that with medications. Their pregnancy rates are lower if their BMI is too high.
That's right. And they're going to use a lot more medication.
Right.
And they're going to have longer stimulation and a lower pregnancy
yeah.
rate.
And remember, we even published our own mm-hmm. abstract
about
on looking at
ago,
our
right?
Correct, on our patients and the quantity of medication required to get the same response mm-hmm. if women were overweight.
And it's interesting because, you know, we'll see these women in the office, and a lot of times the first thing we'll say is, we need to start working on this. And I would never, ever, ever pretend that that's an easy thing to do. But again, you take this team approach, and what a lot of women don't realize is that if they become pregnant and they are obese, there is a 2 to 3 times higher risk of having a significant issue in pregnancy called preeclampsia. More common to have infants with birth defects, 3 times greater risk of miscarriage, 4 times greater risk of gestational diabetes. Wow.
So important. And preeclampsia is where women become hypertensive. Their blood pressure goes up, and it can become very severe and a threat to their life. Now, once again, to help women lower their weight will help their baby. And that's
exactly
real
right.
important. And most of us would do anything for our children mm-hmm. and our babies. And I think that's very important.
It is. And, you know, on the opposite end of the spectrum, it's kind of funny. You know, we have a lot of women in this city that are very, very fit. And they walk in and they just look like they should be on, you know, fitness magazine cover. But to be honest with you, if you get a BMI that's less than 18, that's significantly detrimental to fertility and pregnancy also.
No question about it. And, you know, we used to think until we really saw this data that we could just overcome the hormonal abnormalities from being so lean.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that even with correcting that, we still have lower chances of conceiving. So there was one study that tried to bring this together to say, well, what's too much? Well, it probably has to do with what's it doing to your body.
Right.
So you have to individualize it. But maybe not exceeding 4 days a week of 1 hour of aerobics for those 4 days is probably a healthy amount of exercise. And that's real discouraging to the women that really exercise because it's pretty addicting.
It is, and they don't want to stop. I'm going to give you a little anecdotal story, and then we'll kind of wrap things up. But had a patient about 3 years ago who came in and would not stop running. And in order to ovulate, she had to take these shots every day and be monitored very closely with blood draws and ultrasounds. She comes in to see me this past year, and she walks in and I see she's gained about 10 or 15 pounds. I think she looks great. I said, "What happened?" She said, I hurt my knee and I had to have knee surgery. And she still wasn't ovulating regularly, but she was able to ovulate and become pregnant almost immediately with an oral medication that she only had to take for 5 days that cost $5 compared to about $2,000 she'd had to spend 2 years earlier.
It took an injured knee to get her there. Oh, my gosh. Well, all these are really important issues. And we could talk a little bit longer, I'm sure, if we had more time.
Jessica won't let us. She's going to make us stop talking. <You're> gonna...
Well, thank you once again for listening to Beyond the Birds and the Bees. I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn with Dr. Lisa Hanser, and we're Talk Radio 1370. Next week, we're going to start launching into how we evaluate patients for infertility after we get beyond all of these recommendations for changes in behavior.
And please feel free to visit us, Texas Fertility Center, on the web at www.txfertility.com. Thanks for joining us, and we hope to have you listen with us next week.
Talk Radio, 1370 AM.